Blog Talk Radio.
Jam-packed show, got a lot of stuff. This is my song. I have the voice of an angel. What's that from? With Will Ferrell, the movie with Will Ferrell. I don't know why I'm blanking on the name right now. Probably all you guys are screaming it, but I can't hear you. Where he starts singing, Step Brothers. I got it. See? The old noggin. It's cranking up. It's got to, like, you know, fire into a higher gear before I actually do the stories, where he starts singing. It's like, you have the voice of an angel. That's me. That's me today. I think I'm going to do American Idol next time it comes around. Is that done? Is that off the air? I feel like maybe it is and I missed it. They did 93 seasons. I watched one of them as a child and then never cared. All right, so today, what do I have for you? I have Hillary Clinton's corruption still oozing from every single pore. No, I'm not going to stop fucking covering it because she's up against Donald Trump, a fascist buffoon. I give you all the facts. So I remind you on a daily basis that Donald Trump is a fascist buffoon, and I tell you just how corrupt Hillary Clinton is because I give a shit about the truth. I know it's a crazy thing to witness. We also have CNN's Chris Cuomo basically admitting how they're in the tank for Hillary Clinton.
Stop it.
All right. Then we also have Paul Krugman of the New York Times. He spoke out about what he thinks motivates Trump voters. And I partially agree with him and partially disagree with him. And I think there's an interesting psychological reason as to why he's making the argument that he's making. And then later on in the show, we have some good news on the issue of marijuana. And I have, I don't know, man, you think I'm going to get to every single fucking story today? You're crazy if you think that. Usain Bolt, we have Ellen DeGeneres being accused of racism because of a tweet she sent out about Usain Bolt. So we'll discuss that and much more. But first, let's kick it off here with this super detailed story on Hillary Clinton's transition team and what it signals about the kind of administration she'll have and the kind of campaign she's going to continue to run. As I say that, I'm looking at myself in the monitor, and good googly moogly, do I need to shave. It's, by the way, it's not like I never grow out this fucking creepy-ass faux beard on purpose. It's almost always because of laziness. All right, let's do it. The International Business Times has a detailed report out from David Sirota on Hillary Clinton's transition team, and it's bad. It's a dumpster fire, and it tells you quite a bit about Hillary Clinton and who she is at her core. So he explains here, Hillary Clinton announced that her White House transition team will be led by Ken Salazar, a former lawmaker who left government to become a partner at a major law and lobbying firm. The announcement Tuesday comes as Clinton has campaigned against the so-called revolving door that allows politicians to shuttle between public and private sector work. Salazar served as Colorado's Attorney General, U.S. Senator, and Interior Secretary before traveling through the revolving door and taking a job in 2013 as a partner at WilmerHale, a law and lobbying colossus that has been called one of the most influential forces in Washington. Okay, so let's note the hypocrisy here. As she's giving speeches against the revolving door, this is so bad and this corrupts our system. She's like, I'm going to hire to lead my transition team a guy who is the epitome of the revolving door and that system and just how rotten and grotesque and disgusting it is. He continues here. Salazar's firm has lobbied for corporations who are likely to have significant business with the next presidential administration. For example, the most recent lobbying filings show the firm in 2016 has represented Cigna as it pursues a controversial merger with Anthem. Records show the firm also has represented Delta Airlines, investment firm Lazard Group, insurance giant Liberty Mutual, telecommunications behemoth Verizon, and Newmont Mining. Over the course of the 2016 campaign, Clinton has faced questions about her ongoing ties to the influence industry. Despite her anti-lobbyist rhetoric, she has raised more than $7 million from registered lobbyists. Now, understand, she's actually raised way more than that, but because of some rules that currently exist, oftentimes when people become lobbyists, they have to do it under a different name to skirt the few remaining government rules we have left on that front. So they're effectively lobbyists, but they call themselves something else, and they're also giving Hillary Clinton money. But what they're saying here is from actual registered lobbyists, she's raised $7 million. This is not okay. Now, more about Salazar here. He's for TPP. He thinks it's a fantastic deal. He's in favor of fracking, and he's also for the Keystone XL pipeline. And to one extent or another, he's actually pushed for these policies. And in some cases, he's actually outright lobbied for these policies for various companies that he's worked for. Hillary Clinton picked the ultimate corrupt establishment insider to head her transition team. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is what the media will refer to as a general election pivot. That's it. Why are you guys getting so mad? Of course this is supposed to happen. What do you mean? Yes, during the primary, she mimics all the progressive noises with her mouth. And okay, you got this liberal lion roaring up from her left named Bernie Sanders, who actually gives a fuck about the people and the policy substance. Whatever. So pivot to the left of him on some issues and go, I'm the more liberal one. Oh, my God. Gun policy. Look at this guy. He might as well be blowing the NRA. Am I right? Jesus, look, let me tell you, my Wall Street plan is even tougher than Bernie Sanders. These are arguments that she made. That's half the time, and then the other half the time, oh, no, I'm more moderate. I'm a progressive who likes to get things done. Are you calling me a centrist? Guilty! Well, now, look at what's happening. The second she gets to the general election, and we've seen other, cues that, and clues that point in this direction as well, where do I get all the corporate insiders and lobbyists and establishment people on my team? And let's make sure they're all for TPP and Keystone XL and fracking. And, this way, when I change my mind again, what's she going to say? Oh, look, it wasn't me. It was the experts in the field who told me if I don't do it that I'm crazy. And, look, it's not really the same TPP anymore. I tweaked two or three provisions in the TPP, and now it's a good trade deal, so now I'm for it, but understand it's not hypocrisy because I changed the deal. So the original deal I was against, but now I'm for it because it's different, so shut the fuck up, get off my back. Yeah, this is who I am. And what's amazing to me is, and we're going to get to this story later as well, Donald Trump, who obviously has flip-flopped on a million issues, let's be clear about that, but he said in an interview recently, I'm not going to pivot. I'm not doing a general election pivot because this is who I am. If you pivot, you're lying. Okay, that's the best thing I've ever heard him say. But the media is attacking him. They're attacking him. So Trump's getting attacked over saying, I'm not going to pivot. That's like built-in lying into the system. You say one thing in the primary and then a different thing in the general election. That's stupid. That's ridiculous. Why does everybody just assume, like, oh, that's how you have to do it? That's just because strategists told you to do it. But that is lying, and that's built-in flip-flopping. That's crazy. So Trump gets attacked for that. Hillary Clinton, who's hiring people that make her go back on every single campaign promise she made to actual progressives and liberals, she's not getting attacked for this. The only people – so you have David Sirota of the International Business Times. You have, a few other online print media outlets. But in mainstream media, they're not like, oh, my goodness, this shows that she's too much of a corporate insider and she's too pro-establishment. They're not doing that. And you wonder why people, you know, fewer and fewer people are watching mainstream media, and millennials despise it, and the ratings have been horrendous. Well, actually, to be fair, since it's the election, they've actually shot up, but I guarantee you they'll go back down because everybody goes up during the election. But can you maintain that audience? I guarantee you they cannot because they're terrible at their job. Look, everybody knows where my opinions are as to the ranking of the candidates. But that will never stop me from giving you all the data and all the information and telling you the problems with the different candidates. If you think Hillary Clinton is going to represent change, you're either ignorant or stupid. She's not going to change anything. Best case scenario, absolute best case scenario, and this is like would be the best case scenario, Hillary Clinton is an exact continuation of Barack Obama. But even that's me being too kind to her. Because what's much more likely is that she'll be a little further right on the spectrum. And what's certainly possible is that she'll be significantly further right than Obama. I mean, Obama's done 7 military interventions. You know, there's a chance Hillary Clinton escalates in Syria. There's a chance she takes a more standoffish attitude and escalates with Iran and Russia. So, you know, you go for Hillary Clinton to basically hold your nose and say, okay, I'll deal with 4 more years or 8 more years of business as usual and the establishment and corporatism. And the choice is that versus potential apocalypse. Now, some people will not agree with my assessment of Donald Trump in that respect, but that's based on a lot of different things. I mean, the guy's a fucking loose cannon, and he's a crazy person. But facts are facts, man. Hillary Clinton is deeply corrupt. She's a liar. She's the ultimate insider. And it's not like that stuff stops being true because her opponent is a fascist buffoon. So if you stop talking about Hillary Clinton's faults, well, you're part of the problem and you really don't care about facts above all else. So this transition team is horrendous. And every single liberal and progressive in the United States of America should be outraged by this. There should be an uproar over this. And we should say, you have to earn our fucking votes. But here's what's going on in Hillary's mind. I don't have to earn dick because he's so bad, and we all know that he's so bad that you got no fucking choice. This is how she's thinking. So here's what's going to happen. I'm going to go pander to fundamentalist Mormons in Utah, as she did. She wrote an op-ed trying to court them. I'm going to brag about neocon endorsements. She did that too. I'm going to set up a program to do outreach to disaffected Republicans, all the while Bernie voters are sitting around like, you going to do anything for us, maybe, a little bit, something? What's the biggest fig leaf she offered Bernie supporters? Maybe you could tweak some provisions in the platform. Maybe I'll meet him halfway on education policy. But outside of that, Ken Salazar is my dog. Is that his name? Did I fuck it up? Yes, Ken Salazar. It sounded fake. I don't know why. Outside of that, this guy, pro-TPP, pro-fracking, ultimate insider, yeah, he's going to head my transition team because this is just me doing my general election pivot. Yes, it means I'm incredibly establishment. I'm an insider. I'm corrupt. But, hey, this is the way the game is played, right? Well, you think that, don't be surprised when many people in the progressive base sit home. Everybody's given the bullshit number. 90% of Bernie supporters are going to go for Hillary. That's not true. You have to look at how the polls are done. In that instance, they gave people just the choice. If you had to pick between Trump and Hillary, who's better, who's worse? Then 90% of Bernie supporters go, well, look, I despise Hillary, but obviously she's better than Trump. When you give people more options, oh, Trump, Hillary Clinton, Jill Stein, Gary Johnson, stay home, write in a candidate. Then it's only like 50, 60% of Bernie supporters who are like, all right, Hillary Clinton. So Trump is imploding right now, and she's leading in pretty much every poll. Those are the facts. But understand, she's doing as much as she can to still keep this a race, because she can't help herself but snub her base at every turn. Okay. All right, now we're going to go to Chris Cuomo here in a second. Let me just jot something down here real quick. Okay, let's do it. This guy is one of those standard button-down hosts from CNN. His daddy was the governor, and now his brother's the governor. So he's an ultimate insider, and you're kind of going to see that in his opinions and how he explains himself. CNN's Chris Cuomo recently admitted something about Hillary Clinton that he's likely regretting at the moment. So let's see what actually two hosts on CNN have to say about Hillary Clinton and her candidacy.
Doing what they call in politics, freezing pockets, because the donors are giving her money thinking she's going to run. That means they're not going to have available money for other candidates if she doesn't, and I don't think she's going to give it to them.
She's on her way to deciding.
We'll see.
About deciding.
We couldn't help her any more than we have.
I know.
You know, she's got just a free ride so far from the media. We're the biggest ones promoting her campaign. We couldn't help her any more than we have.
I know.
You know, she's got just a free ride so far from the media. We're the biggest ones promoting her campaign.
The most embarrassing thing I've ever seen in my life. You're admitting that you don't do your job. Now, don't get me wrong. I actually think it makes sense if you're a journalist and you favor one candidate over another candidate. But the most important thing is you have to care about the facts first. So even if you support one candidate over another candidate, you have to be willing to say, here's where the candidate that I like better is wrong, and I'm going to give you all the facts and give you all of my reasoning. So here's what led me to my conclusion that this person is better than that person, but here are all the facts, all the data, all the information on this person, and I'm not going to suppress anything because I like this person more. In other words, I'm not going to be a cheerleader. I'm not going to root for this person and go, rah, rah, yay, and you know, actively withhold information from you because I've already decided that this is my person. Well, Chris Cuomo is basically admitting that that's what he does. He says she's gotten a free ride from the media. So, in other words, it's not just that, hey, okay, I think Hillary's better than Donald Trump. That's a totally fine opinion to have. It's that I think she's better, and because of that, I'm not going to tell you the bad things and the wrong things about Hillary Clinton. Well, dude, that's a fireable offense on a planet that makes sense, because you're admitting I'm not doing the one thing that is my job as somebody who's a journalist, as somebody who's a reporter, to give everybody all the data, all the information, all the details. You're saying, no, one of the candidates gets a free ride. That's not okay. That's not okay. And this really does help put in perspective for you. For example, what happened with Bernie Sanders in the primary? Now, to people who are super well-informed on the policy issues, we all knew Bernie Sanders had a track record, decades of fighting for progressive reform. And, you know, we were waiting for the media, okay, let's get to that part of it. Instead, they're focusing on the horse race aspect of it and having silly discussions. But we're sitting there waiting, okay, where are the details on the policy substance? We all know it because we've read about it, but we're waiting for you to talk about it. And a lot of people do not know the facts about Bernie Sanders, and, you know, he got arrested for fucking protesting segregation and all these amazing things about him. Very little discussion about that. So Hillary Clinton, if you had an open and honest conversation about her and gave all the facts during the primary, what would they have to say about Hillary? Okay, she voted for the Iraq War. That's a problem. Here were the effects of that vote. Okay, she voted for the Patriot Act. Yes, that's restricting civil liberties, and that's not exactly constitutional. There are major issues with that. Okay, she was in favor of deregulation. In fact, her husband signed the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which repealed the Glass-Steagall, which was a horrible decision. Okay, she was in favor of NAFTA. She spoke about that. She's on the record about that. Okay, she pushed for TPP 45 times, and now she says she's against it in the primary, but that's not exactly true. And, You can go on and on. She was in favor of the action in Libya and the leader in the action in Libya, and that turned out to be a horrible idea. She wanted to be more involved in Syria. You know, she keeps saying, oh, I was, you know, I orchestrated the Iran deal. That's totally misleading. She was against Obama even going to Iran. She called him naive for saying, I'll speak to them without preconditions. So she wasn't in favor of opening up the lines of communication, and now she's taking credit for the fucking deal that Obama ironed out with John Kerry, again, when he's the one who wanted to talk to him, and she didn't even want to talk to them. So all of these things, her Wall Street ties, just her ties to big business in general, you have, if you're a serious news outlet, you have to say, here's how much money she's taken. Here's the potential conflict of interest with that. Here's why that's a problem. She's the ultimate insider. Yes, there are instances of her flipping her votes because of donor money. You could talk about the taking money from the health industry. She was for single-payer health care, then all of a sudden she's against it after she took a lot of money. The bankruptcy bill, which biased the laws in favor of big corporations, she was against it, then she ran for Senate, took big money, and then all of a sudden she flipped. Now she's in favor of the bankruptcy bill that biases the laws in favor of corporations. If you're serious, you talk about these things. They did not talk about these things to any serious degree. As a result of that, less information was out there about who the better candidate is based on policy substance, and Bernie Sanders lost, even though he made an amazing charge. He got 46% of the vote when he's a 312-year-old Jewish, maybe atheist, socialist, self-described socialist, democratic socialist. He still managed to get 46% of the vote with the entire media not giving him a fair shot and with the entire media not holding Hillary Clinton accountable. Well, now we know one of the main reasons why. And remember, it's not like Chris Cuomo, oh, he's just one guy, this isn't a mindset that's happening at CNN. Oh, come on. Does anybody really believe that? Do you guys really believe that? I mean, it was Cuomo who hosted one of the town halls. And if you remember, I remember live-tweeting it and thinking, Jesus, man, the questions for Bernie are much more aggressive and actually kind of hacky. Like, they're attempts at gotcha questions. They're not real substance questions. And for Hillary Clinton, I mean, when they started the town hall, he was saying, Cuomo was saying to Hillary, did you ever think you'd be in a tight race with a, you know, whatever, old guy named Bernie? It's so smug and so condescending, but now we know why. Because they're admitting, free ride. Free ride. Guys, I get it. Trump is a dangerous buffoon. I'm not telling you to reel back your coverage of Trump, all the negative coverage of Trump. Oh, my God, he said this. Oh, my God, he said that. You've been doing actually a decent job recently. A while back, it was almost all PC outrage against Donald Trump. But now they're actually focusing on some of the substantive stuff and saying, okay, that policy makes no sense. Here's why. Here's his contradictions. I'm not telling you to reel in on Trump. Still cover Trump aggressively. But I'm telling you, you also have to stop giving Hillary Clinton a free ride. Because that's not your fucking job, and you should know that. Okay. Let me take a quick break now. When we come back, we got Paul Krugman of the New York Times on what he thinks of Trump voters, and I got Donald Trump talking about the general election pivot and what he thinks of it. All right, stay right there, guys. We'll be right back.
Crowd has a name. Right or wrong, and for me, what's wrong? It is known. It's a dream from the wall.
back, guys. Okay, let's go to Paul Krugman here. He has some thoughts on Trump supporters for us. I partially agree with him, partially disagree with him. So let's get into that. Paul Krugman of the New York Times sat down with Bloomberg TV, and he spoke about what he thinks motivates Trump voters.
He obviously has his background, but he also is trying to target a sort of American that feels like they're out of economic luck, and they're looking to him to sort of bring them up. How much of that sort of economic malaise that is still sort of out there in the U.S. is contributing to his following and to his support base?
I mean, most, if you actually look at,
I'm just retailing what I hear from other people. I mean, I talk to political scientists. I take them very seriously, and they say that, you know, economic anxiety is not a very good predictor of who's a Trump supporter. Basically, racial antagonism is a good predictor of who's a Trump supporter. Now, there may be some interaction effect. Maybe if the country were really booming and wages were rising and manufacturing was still strong, all of that racial anxiety would be somewhat on hold, although I'm not even sure about that if you look at the history of this stuff. But the idea that this is what it's about, that his China bashing is trade stuff, is really behind the movement. I think all that's happening is that all of these subterranean impulses that have been driving a lot of the Republican vote for decades are now just coming to the surface.
I have the answer. I think it's both things. So his argument is, well, it's more of the fact that they're just bigots, they're just xenophobes, they're just racists. They have this fear of the United States of America becoming less and less white, and the statistics bear out that aspect of it, that indeed that is happening, and the number of minorities in the U.S., it's growing, and the number of white people, or the percentage of white people over time, is going down, down, down. And what he's saying is, if anything, the lion's share of the blame goes to just their attitudes and their ideology, and he thinks economics is secondary. The reality is, I think that there is an interaction going on there. So are there going to be bigots and xenophobes and racists to a certain extent, no matter what you do, even if everybody had a great life? There are people who are poisoned either by a religious ideology or just by basic tribalism, where they're going to be racists and xenophobes and bigots no matter what. Yes. But do you make it much less likely that those impulses become predominant and powerful and an important election factor if everybody's doing well and if everybody has a good middle-class life? The answer to that is also definitely yes. So both things are true, but what I fear is the way that Paul Krugman is talking about this, he's being far too dismissive, and he's basically downplaying the economic angle and playing up the race angle. And I think he's doing that because he's trying to absolve the neoliberal elites of their part in destroying the middle class of this country and creating a monster like Trump. I've maintained from the beginning, you simply cannot have a successful Donald Trump presidency, or campaign, I should say, if it wasn't for the fact that the entire establishment has been so immensely disconnected from the people for so long. I mean, remember, guys, the establishment, across the board, they agree, more so-called free trade deals, which are just outsourcing deals. They, across the board, agree, unions should have less power, and we should either regulate a little bit or regulate not at all. So things that used to have a wider spectrum of agreement and disagreement, where Democrats would say, we're simply pro-union, we think we should do more regulation, we don't think we should outsource deals. If you had a vibrant and thriving Democratic Party and the Democrats were actual liberals and progressives and not neoliberals, and the Democratic Party didn't, for example, repeal Glass-Steagall and, you know, didn't, for example, sign NAFTA, if you had the Democrats fighting for the people, yes, I don't think that this backlash and this pro-Trump vote and movement would be as strong as it is, because it's a lot harder to hate the other when your bills are paid for and you're rather comfortable. Now, again, as I said earlier on. It is true that sometimes, yes, you're still going to have people who are bigots and racists no matter what, even if everybody has a middle-class lifestyle. But there would be fewer of them, and it wouldn't be as big of a driving force. Because when people are down on their luck, they feel the need to scapegoat. And they want to blame the Muslims, and they want to blame the Mexicans, and they want to blame the black people. And Donald Trump is tapping into that, and he's mixing in a healthy dose of economic populism. So if you take away either one of the prongs of Donald Trump, he wouldn't be as successful. If you take away the xenophobia and the bigotry, he wouldn't be as successful in the Republican primary. If you take away the economic populism, he wouldn't be as successful. So both parts of this matter. But I think Paul Krugman, he's trying to downplay the economic angle, because if you downplay the economic angle, what do you get to say? All these fucking Trump voters, they're just crazy people, they're just stupid people, they're just bigots, they have no legitimate concerns, and that's more of what's driving them. Well, if you acknowledge that, well, it's at least partially also an economic issue, that they really have been fucked over by globalization and left behind. If you acknowledge that, well, then it's also the Democratic Party and the neoliberals who have a lot to answer for. Because, again, they're part of the establishment, and they've been driving us in the direction of screwing over the middle class more and more along with the Republicans. And they're not actual liberals and progressives who believe in a New Deal type system, who believe in social democracy, and who actually fight for these people. You know, again, it's much harder to hate the other when you're comfortable and make a decent living. But in part because of economics, and yes, in part because of hateful ideology spread by talk radio and spread by Fox News, both of those things together, you mix them together, and you get Trumpenstein. And that's where we're at right now. Okay. Okay, let's go to Donald Trump here. And actually give him a little bit of credit. Kind of. Very, very little bit. You'll see. You'll see exactly what I mean. I'll explain. Donald Trump made some comments about doing a general election pivot on a local news show in Wisconsin. Let's see what he has to say.
Well, possibly I do, but, you know, I am who I am. It's me. I don't want to change. Everyone talks about, oh, well, you're going to pivot. I don't want to pivot. I mean, you have to be you. If you start pivoting, you're not being honest with people. And because I've heard this over the years and, you know, with politics, with general politics, also having to do with me. No, I am who I am. I've gotten here in a landslide, and we'll see what happens.
So the media has taken this comment, and they're acting like cackling hyenas. He's not going to pivot! 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 Okay, so where's the big scandal? They're like, see, what this shows is he obviously doesn't understand the way the game of politics is played. He's throwing out the rule book. And he's winging it, and this shows it right here, and God, he's so stupid, and he's so dumb, and this is a great example of it right here. Okay, there's a million and one things to go after Trump for, and I do it. I do it better and more effectively and efficiently than all these idiots out there. This is not one of the things to attack him on. In fact, if you are attacking him on this, you're an idiot. So understand, yes, Trump has flip-flopped on virtually every single issue. He's a contradiction machine, and I've covered that in detail. In fact, I just covered it either earlier in this week or the end of last week. So let's keep that in mind for sure. But in isolation, the point that I'm not going to do a general election pivot because I am who I am and embedded in a pivot is a lie, that's totally true. Of course that's true. I mean, look at how brainwashed by our current system the mainstream media is. Like, they've totally forgotten that there was a time when money in politics, it was rightly viewed with shame and scorn. So you know, if a candidate did raise a lot of money, it wasn't a thing where the media was like, ah, see, they raised a lot of money. They're doing really well. It was like, okay, we raised a lot of money, but try to keep it on the DL because, you know, people aren't idiots. They know that this comes with strings attached. It's not like I'm taking money from all these corporations and they don't expect something in return, because it wasn't even always the case that we had unlimited money in U.S. politics. It was in the late 1970s that we started a series of Supreme Court decisions that allowed money in politics. But today the media discusses money in politics like it's just part of the system and it's a race and, ooh, Hillary Clinton's doing better. She sold out more to big business. Good for her. Well, this is another instance right here. Did you guys know it used to be the case that when people did a general election pivot, when the candidates did that, if a moderator brought it up to them like, oh, are you pivoting? They would have to downplay it and be like, no, I'm standing by everything I said in the primary, because they knew that a pivot embedded in a pivot, implied in a pivot, is I'm going to go back on the shit I said in the primary. I was just sweet-talking you to get your fucking panties off. Now I got the panties off, and I'm trying to win over other voters, moderate voters, in the general election. So if you bring up to them, oh, you're pivoting, you say, no, I'm consistent. That's what I am. I'm not pivoting. I don't know what you're talking about. But now the idiot mainstream pundit class in the U.S., they're so brainwashed by the way the strategists have determined the systems work, that they think, like, they want to encourage candidates. Like, are you going to pivot? Like, when are you going to go back on everything you said and make let everybody know it's a lie? Like, oh, everything I said in the primary, irrelevant. Now I'm in the general, I'm a new person. Like, they're cheerleading a pivot. They're like, okay, when are you going to lie? When are you going to change your mind? When are you going to flip-flop? What kind of fucking idiot moron reporters do this? What kind of a disgusting, rotten, rank journalism reporter system here encourages this shit? So Trump says the most reasonable thing he's ever said. I'm against the pivot. I'm not going to pivot. I'm going to fucking say the same shit I said. And instead of their takeaway being, wow, if he means that, that's super honest and the right thing to do and consistent, instead of doing that, they're pointing their finger and laughing. Well, guys, this is one of many reasons why he's done so well, is that a lot of the things in the rule book for elections are stupid, and he came along and he was like, yeah, fuck that part. That part makes no goddamn sense. I'm not doing that. Why the fuck would I do that? There used to be an unwritten rule of, you know, look, nobody bring up the money in the system because we're all fucking taking it. So if you bring it up on the primary stage, for example, you know, you've crossed the line and that is taboo in their circles. Trump was like, bitch, I'm not with you guys. And he wasn't able to raise as much money from the donors because they don't fucking like him. So what does he do? He's like, you're all puppets. You're all puppets of the donors. So I'm going to say that. Again, this was another unwritten rule. Like, you don't talk about the money in the system. He's like, I don't care about that rule. I'm just going to say whatever. And this is why the entire pundit class was flummoxed by his winning in the primary. Like, but he broke all the rules. Yeah, but your rules were fucking stupid. The general election pivot is another stupid one. Like, why would we all casually accept it? The pivot is the dumbest thing in politics. I remember when I was a fucking political science student in college and we're discussing this early on, because this is one of the things that you talk about early on. I'm like, why do we all just accept that? In the primary, they say, I'm this person if you're a Republican. I'm super conservative if you're a Democrat. I'm super liberal. And then in the general, you're like, I'm moderate. I'm like, why do we accept that from anybody? Because obviously at one point they weren't telling the truth. You want to encourage them to lie? The media can't help themselves. Can't help themselves. So, and by the way, like, they act like, this is proving that he's going to be super far right like he was in the primary. Again, gross, sloppy thinking, because it's Donald Trump, so they don't care about being specific and accurate in what the reality is. Donald Trump maintained during the primary, I'm not going to cut Social Security, I'm not going to cut Medicare. He said it repeatedly, he doubled down on it, bucking Republican orthodoxy. He said, I'm going to do infrastructure spending, bucking Republican orthodoxy. He said, I'm against TPP, bucking Republican orthodoxy. He said, at times, half the time, the other half the time he said, I'm going to be the biggest interventionist, but half the time he said, I don't want to be involved in all these wars, we're wasting money. So bucking Republican orthodoxy. So the idea that, like, oh, he's not going to pivot and that means he's still super far right, only in some ways is he super far right. In other ways, he's actually to the left of the Republican Party, and in some ways his rhetoric is to the left of Hillary Clinton. So it's just, I don't know. You know, what drives me crazy is the way the media goes after Trump in many respects is just, I can't co-sign it because they don't know what they're doing or what they're saying. Like, there's so many things to go after him for. We have to take out their families, fucking kill civilians in the Middle East, torture. The Geneva Conventions is the problem. We have to lower wages. You know who knows how to go after Donald Trump? Bernie Sanders knows how to go after Donald Trump because he cares about the policy substance. The media, they don't care about policy substance. So, you know, Trump says anything, even if it's vanilla and banal and just obviously rational, and they're like, oh, that's so stupid! It's so stupid because you said it and you're Donald Trump, so it's stupid, right? Right? No. Somebody finally speaking out against the goofy, stupid idea of a general election pivot is actually fucking awesome. Now we move on to the issue of Saudi Arabia and their bomb orgy. So yesterday we discussed the Saudi bombing of a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Yemen, killing at least 10 people and wounding over 20. They say that they were trying to get a Houthi rebel stronghold, but Doctors Without Borders has now released the fact that they repeatedly told the Saudi government and they repeatedly told all sides in the conflict that these are our coordinates, we are here, this is a hospital, don't do anything here. Nonetheless, Saudi bombed. So the day before that, we also discussed another Saudi bombing, this time of a school in Yemen. On top of that, they recently bombed a marketplace, they bombed a potato chip factory, and they bombed the main bridge to get into an area of Yemen that desperately needs continued humanitarian aid. So I think you guys are seeing a pattern here. They might maintain, oh, it's such an accident. We keep hitting civilians. One time they hit a school for the blind. That's the point, guys. This is what they're doing. What, you think all of a sudden the Saudi government decided to pull a good set of ethics out of their ass when we already know that, you know, women are forced to cover up, they're officially second-class citizens, we have all atheists are declared terrorists, they behead people for witchcraft and sorcery and drug smuggling. No, obviously this isn't a government that's overly concerned with human rights. The whole premise of the government is to do the opposite, not be in favor of human rights, be in favor of fundamentalist Islam, Salafi Islam. So, now we finally have the U.S. State Department saying something about what's been going on over there. The Intercept reports here. After the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition bombed a hospital in Yemen supported by Doctors Without Borders on Monday, the U.S. State Department offered a rare condemnation of the coalition's violence. Quote, of course we condemn the attack, said Elizabeth Trudeau, a spokesman for the State Department. Now, that's good, so we got to step in the right direction. You're condemning it. Lovely, lovely. Now, in terms of finding a way to ameliorate the problem, finding a way to just overall make sure it doesn't happen again, maybe, or bring people to justice, that crazy idea, they continue here. Quote, despite the condemnations, Trudeau refused to say whether the State Department would reconsider arming the Saudi regime. Here's her exact quote. I have nothing to preview on that. So let's put this into perspective and let's put this into context. The Saudi government repeatedly bombed schools, they repeatedly bombed hospitals, they repeatedly bombed mosques, they repeatedly bombed marketplaces, they've bombed the main way that humanitarian aid gets into the region. They've gone after civilians ruthlessly, viciously, and obviously on purpose to anybody that has a set of eyes. They've displaced millions of people within their own country. They've killed over 7,000 people since the beginning of the bombing, over 50% of them civilians. And this is the best that you're going to get from the U.S. Why? They're our ally. So the best you get is, of course we condemn the attacks. Okay, great. Now, are you going to do something about it? No. That's cute. All right, then do me a favor. I don't want to hear anything from you guys ever with your bullshit crocodile tears about how much you care about the effects of terrorism. Because this is terrorism. And there's another angle to this grotesque monstrosity of a situation as well, which is we give Saudi Arabia, they turn around and arm Sunni militias on the ground in Yemen fighting against the Shia Houthi rebels. Who are those Sunni militias? Al-Qaeda. We give them weapons, they give it to Al-Qaeda, and then Al-Qaeda fights in Yemen. And then the next time there's a jihadist attack in the West, of course, the United States, in the strongest terms, we condemn this and we have to stop, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, yeah. You know, there is a way to cut back the effectiveness and the number of attacks coming from that camp. Stop arming them. That crazy idea. Ronald Reagan did it with the Mujahideen. He armed them to fight against the big, bad, godless Soviet Union, the communists. Well, guess what? Later on, the Mujahideen broke up into the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and they used those weapons against us. We're doing it again in Syria. We're arming rebels in Syria because they're against Assad. Whoops, come to find out many of the rebels are Islamists and jihadists. Stop arming them. Did you know Saudi Arabia did these two attacks, the one on the school, the most recent one on the school, and the most recent one on a Doctors Without Borders hospital, directly after the U.S. government announced, we're going to give you $1.15 billion more dollars in weapons, including tanks this time. So, and they go, oh, great. Now let us demonstrate how we will not give a fuck about international law or human rights or any of that stuff after you announce you're going to arm us more. The Canadian government, Justin Trudeau, they decided they're going to give billions of dollars in weapons to Saudi Arabia too. You're making your fucking bed, man, and eventually you're going to sleep in it. You know exactly what you're doing is wrong. You know you're arming some of the worst people on the planet, but you keep doing it anyway. Why? Because business as usual, that's the way things work. So we got an oil deal with them. They're our buddies. They've been for a long time. So we'll look the other way as you do fucked up shit because whatevs, you're on our team, so what are you going to do? Same thing with Israel. Give them weapons, give them money. Oops, are you doing occupation and oppression and an apartheid state of the Palestinians? Well, let me wag my finger at that as we continue to not fix it and do dick. But you're our ally, so yippee skippy. The grotesque hypocrisy on human rights. Imagine a U.S. enemy was this egregious in how they're doing atrocities. Yeah, we bombed a fucking school. Yeah, okay, whatever. We bombed a hospital. We bombed a mosque. We're bombing marketplaces. Whatevs, dude. Whatevs, whatevs. How quickly the U.S. a rogue terrorist nation. That's what it is. And by the way, you think this isn't breeding anti-Americanism? The names on the weapons and the munitions found in many of these places, and they're using cluster bombs, which are against international law, but they have the names of the places these are built in the United States. You think somebody in Yemen is going to see that and go, those lovely Americans, they're wonderful. They're going to go, why the fuck are they arming them? We're also giving them some coordinates. So we're taking a more active role, not just arming them, taking an active role in their massacre of civilians in Yemen. Totally unacceptable. It has to stop. No more of this milquetoast. Of course we condemn it. Show me. Show me what you mean by condemning it. You want to actually stop arming them? How about that? Maybe that's a way to condemn it. You want to slap some fucking sanctions on them? How about that? That's a way to show them you're serious and show the world you actually care about human rights, but you're not going to do it because you don't fucking care, because if they're on our team, in your mind, whatever doesn't count. They're good by definition because we have business deals with them. All right, let me do one more before we take our final break here. The Economist has a fascinating article about how U.S. military bases are becoming more and more controversial around the world. So the U.S. bases in Okinawa are a big deal right now because of a recent rape and sexual assault scandal involving U.S. troops. And this actually isn't the first time. So relatively speaking, the troops who are stationed there, they commit a decent amount of crime. And Okinawans are like, what the fuck? We don't want you here. You're here. And now there's stories of in 95, they raped a 12-year-old girl. There was a gang rape of a 12-year-old girl. Recently, there was a totally different rape scandal. And Okinawans are like, okay, we need you to get the fuck out. Thousands of people marched recently in the streets. They're like, we want you out of here. You're occupying us. We don't fucking want you here. What are you doing here? And so now it's not just the bases in Okinawa that are, you know, that have a scandal and are more controversial. It's also the bases in Turkey. They're coming into question because many people in Turkey think that the U.S. played a role in the attempted coup of the government in Turkey with Erdogan. Now, that's a difficult question to answer because I really don't know. The Turkish government is convinced that Gulen is behind the attempted coup. He's an Islamic cleric who actually lives in the United States. And Erdogan thinks the U.S. probably orchestrated the coup to get Gulen in there because Gulen maybe, maybe not, would be more in alignment with what the U.S. plans on doing from here on out in Syria, though, again, I'm not sure. It gets very complicated, very complex. But there's a lot of people in Turkey who were already anti-American to begin with, and then now they're like, oh, well, fuck you. You got a military base here that you're using to do strikes in Syria and elsewhere. How about we try to get you the fuck out of there? And now the relationships have gone, the relationship has gone cold between Erdogan and the U.S. because after the attempted coup, there was a super, you know, milk toast response from the U.S. government when the coup was going on, where they're like, we hope for continued normalcy with Turkey. Those aren't the exact words, so forgive me because I don't recall them. It was a while ago, but basically, the gist of the statement was, like, we hope things can continue normally with Turkey after the coup. So it wasn't like we strongly condemn the attempted coup when we're on the side of Erdogan and he's our ally and our friend. It wasn't strongly worded. It was more like, let's hedge our bets. Whatever happens, happens. If it's the next guy and there is a successful coup, well, we'll still work with him. So Erdogan saw that. He's like, the Americans are behind this. So listen to... So now you know, in multiple places around the world, these are just two examples, but in other places there are some lower-level scandals and controversies about the U.S. military bases being there. But listen to these facts about the overall numbers, because this is incredible and a lot of people don't know this. They say, America has more overseas military bases than any other nation, nearly 800 spread through more than 70 countries. Of the roughly 150,000 troops stationed abroad, the total cost to the American government with war zones excluded is up to $100 billion a year. I had no idea it cost that much. It costs $100 billion to maintain these 800 military bases all around the world. I need you to stop and think for a second about what else that money can go towards. Dude, we have issues in the U.S. where some places have poisonous water. The infrastructure is so bad, and the decisions of the government have been so corrupt that you can't get clean drinking water in Flint. You can't get it in many other places. You think that could be fixed? According to a recent report, our infrastructure gets a grade of D-. As far as modern nation goes, our infrastructure is falling apart. A lot of the shit is the shit built from the New Deal, and it's just gradually been falling apart since then. And it's more and more corroded. Okay, we need to do a new Deal. We need to fix our infrastructure. We need to reinvest in our cities. Have you seen Detroit? The idea that we have, oh, just $100 billion, whatever, put a fucking base in Botswana, and whatever, we'll blow money on it, because this is our role, because we're the world policemen, ah, yeah, human rights, don't look at our relationship with Saudi Arabia because it proves we don't give a flying fuck about human rights. But human rights, yeah, yeah. So got to have all these military bases or not. Look, I'm not saying get rid of literally every single one. What I am saying is, can we at least cut it by 50% and take $50 billion and put it towards something else? Yeah, yeah, we can. If somebody even tried to make the case that we need literally all 800 bases and we need to spend every penny of the $100 billion on this, I would laugh in their face. I would laugh in their face. Because that's the silliest thing I've ever heard. As if we don't have problems here. So, well, we do need a radical realignment of priorities. In the United States of America, we don't even have single-payer health care. 45,000 people die every year because they don't have access to basic health care. Basic health care. And we're like, okay, $100 billion on military bases in random places around the world. Or not. Or not. It's not written in stone. It's not in the laws of fucking physics or nature that, well, we have to have all these bases and fuck over the people in the United States. No, we don't have to do that. We can change it. We can change. You have to change the policies. That's it. And again, you want to do it gradually over time, fine, whatever, but let's start doing it. Let's start doing it. You can keep the most strategic ones that are most necessary, that's fine. But to have 800 and spend $100 billion a year, and then the saddest part of all, quote, when it comes to these bases, Americans for the most part are completely unaware of them, says David Vine, associate professor of anthropology at the American University. So we have 800 military bases, spend $100 billion on it per year, and Americans don't even know. They don't even know. They don't even fucking know. So I think it's time for a change, and I think it's time to fix our priorities. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, more good news here on the issue of marijuana.
Shame you left my Hi, we're back.
Waka waka. All right, here we go. Some more good news here on the issue of marijuana. This is Reuters. They say the U.S. Department of Justice cannot spend money to prosecute federal marijuana cases if the defendants comply with state guidelines that permit the drug sale for medical purposes, a federal appeals court ruled on Tuesday. The ruling from the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals comes as voters in nine more states, nine guys, will consider allowing the recreational use of marijuana this November. 25 U.S. states currently allow for medical marijuana, while the sale of the drug is still illegal under federal law. Congress in 2014 passed a budget rule which prohibits the DOJ from using federal funds to interfere in the implementation of state marijuana regulations. Okay, so, you know, you could say this specific case here is a mini victory for the marijuana movement, but we got to slam on the brakes here a little bit because I don't think this decision is going to hold up. And in fact, there's a decent argument to be made that this is going to go all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is going to rule in the opposite direction. Now, why is that? Well, in this case, it's not because, you know, necessarily that the higher judges will be – it's funny to say higher judges in the context of this story. It's not that they're going to necessarily be personally anti-marijuana. It's that the legal footing that this stands on is weak. Because what they're saying is the Department of Justice can't spend federal money, somebody for a drug crime, if the crime is happening in a state where it's legal and the people are complying with the regulations in that state. Except they can do that. Why? Because in the Constitution, there's the Supremacy Clause. The Supremacy Clause states that the federal government and federal law overrides state law wherever they conflict. So here you have an instance where, you have federal law saying, no, marijuana is illegal, and state law saying it's legal, and then you have to defer to one source of authority. So who's it going to be? They're going to go with the federal government. Now, again, as they explain here, in 2014, Congress passed a budget rule which prohibits the Department of Justice from using federal funds to interfere with the implementation of state marijuana regulations. But I think that a higher court will even find that that isn't necessarily legal. And that's not correct because it's still clearly written that it is illegal overall. And if it's illegal, it means even medical marijuana is illegal. So technically the federal government can crack down even on medical marijuana if they so choose. So that's why it's always been a very tentative situation in the U.S. with marijuana. Because until you change the federal laws, all you need is a dick president to get in there, and they can crack down on everything on day one if they wanted to. Like Trump, I don't know if you guys know about this, but Trump, like, he maintains that he's never done drugs and super clean and all this stuff, and he's against them. If he were to get elected and he were to decide, I want to shut down all marijuana enterprises in the U.S., in the states where it's legal, I want to get rid of it. And even in the over 20 states where there's medical marijuana, I want to get rid of it. He technically has the authority to do that. But now we're starting to see the fights in the court system as to the legality of it. And my fear is that the decision is going to be that the federal law that states that it's illegal, that would need to be changed by Congress in order to make it legal. Because if Congress doesn't change that main law saying that marijuana is illegal, well, then it's always going to be on the books and it's always going to override any lower law at the state level that would say it is legal. So, and understand, guys, again, the court wouldn't even necessarily be wrong. Like, if I was a judge hearing out this case, I would have to rule on the side of slapping down weed. And I'd have to rule on the side of the Department of Justice can use funds to go after, people who are committing marijuana crimes in the different states, because the precedent that you're setting is what matters. And the precedent is a legal precedent, extends far beyond just this instance. So another example of this would be, let's say they have, Let's say they passed a state law legalizing grenade launchers and in Mississippi. And the federal government, the Department of Justice is like, well, we're going to spend money prosecuting the people who own fucking grenade launchers because they can't do that. They can't own that. We don't let them. But then the argument is, no, the state allows them to, and they're complying with all the regulations. Well, then, you know, what's the court going to decide in that case? If their logic stays true, they'd have to say, well, no, as long as they're complying with the state laws, it's okay. Yeah, but that's not okay. Federal law overrides state law. So the problem with the marijuana debate is that you just have to change that one law. You have to change the law that says marijuana is illegal at a federal level. If you don't change that law, then these are just going to be temporary victories for the marijuana movement. So I need everybody to understand the nuance of this situation, and I need everybody to understand this probably will not hold up in higher courts. And it's probably a good thing that it doesn't hold up because of the precedent it would set if it did hold up. So you just need to get that law changed. That's the bottom line here. Now, you can make a separate case that, hey, it's a constitutional right to be able to purchase marijuana and consume marijuana. There'd be a stronger argument for that than for the legal framework that this case is set on. Okay. Next. Civil asset forfeiture. Let's talk about it. So we have some news here that allows us to shine a light on a horrific practice that still goes on in the U.S. Raw Story explains, civil asset forfeiture has become increasingly controversial in recent years as we've seen several stories of law enforcement officials abusing their authority to seize suspects' property that they allege was involved in a crime. South Carolina news station WYFF4 reports that police departments in the state have raked in an estimated $22.7 million in property seizures over the last 5 years alone. A group called the Institute for Justice, who tracks this, gives South Carolina a grade of D- on the issue. And here's the most amazing part. Person does not need to be charged or even convicted of a crime to lose their property. You can be acquitted of a charge in criminal court, but still lose your property through civil forfeiture. Guys, this is a situation where we have legalized robbery if the people doing the robbery are police officers. That's what this is. So they can go around, they can seize your property. I think this is involved in a crime. What? It's not. What are you talking about? It's not involved in a crime. I disagree. And now you have no recourse to get it back. Even if you're not charged with a crime and you're not convicted, we still get to keep it. What the fuck is that? So understand, this is just one example from South Carolina. We've covered stories before of police departments throughout the country. There are some that, oh, we bought a new margarita-making machine. We bought a new coffee machine. We built a new wing on our department, all through funds that were seized with civil asset forfeiture. This is fucking crazy. I've been using this reference too often recently, but we've codified into the system Alonzo from Training Day and his philosophy. The idea of like, yeah, no, you know, you can't be a sheep to catch a wolf. You got to be a wolf to catch a wolf. So therefore, when I'm a bad guy, it doesn't count because I have the bad, so I'm a good guy by definition. So when I do the exact same things and copy the tactics of the bad guys, I'm still a good guy. No, you're not, and that mental gymnastics wasn't even remotely convincing. So, no, if you're an officer, you shouldn't be allowed to do civil asset forfeiture, which is a glorified way of saying robbery, and say, it's okay, don't worry, no, it's cool, I have a badge. I don't give a fuck about your badge, you could shove it up your ass, you just took somebody's money, you just took somebody's property. And understand, man, what allows this to persist? The fucking drug war is the main culprit. If we just end the drug war, and at the very least decriminalize drugs, but we actually should just legalize, tax, and regulate drugs. But if we just ended the drug war, do you understand, like, more than 50% of the reason why many police departments basically occupy poor communities? It would be gone. You can't justify it anymore. What are you going to do? You're going to sit there? No, if your job is to just go after violent fucking criminals, well, then I would guess that, you know, there'd be much less tension between the community and police officers. They go, what do you mean? These are the guys that show up when there's a fucking assault or a murder. Yeah, we want them here to protect us, of course. But when they're there and half the fucking time they're just harassing you because you got a little weed on you, well, then they become the enemy, of course. And then when they jack your property and your money and go, it's cool, I have a badge, well, then obviously you're going to set up a situation where the people and the police department clash. So this has got to stop, and it's got to stop now. End civil asset forfeiture. Now let's move on to Ellen. Ellen was accused of racism. Jeez, my stomach is growling. Fucking hungry. Still got 15 minutes left in the show. You might actually hear it on the microphone. Okay, here we go. Usain Bolt is, of course, the fastest man on the planet, and he's continuing to dominate the Olympics. Well, Ellen DeGeneres decided to get in on the fun here and tweet a joke. So she said, this is how I'm running errands from now on, hashtag Rio2016, and it's a picture of her on Usain Bolt's back. She's basically piggybacking on him, quite literally. Well, some corners of the internet were not very happy about this and immediately accused Ellen of racism. So let me give you just some of the responses here. Somebody said, seriously, what the fuck? Honestly, this is offensive. And then, so riding on his back like a mule, a horse, as some form of property is fun to you? ... Okay. And it went on for a while. It went on so much that, in fact, Ellen tweeted again at a later point after seeing the backlash, quote, I am highly aware of the racism that exists in our country. It is the furthest thing from who I am. And then some people took that, and they're like, well, she didn't even fucking apologize. She didn't even apologize. Look at how she worded it. She said she's against racism, but I'm not sorry for what I did. Therefore, racist bitch. Let me give you a little more context on this so you begin to see what a reasonable verdict is. First of all, Usain Bolt retweeted the photo. So he was so personally outraged and offended by it, and he thought it was so deeply racist that he retweeted it. And then right before tweeting the picture in question, Ellen actually tweeted a link to the trailer for the upcoming movie Hidden Figures, which focuses on the unsung black heroes of NASA. Now, obviously, what she's doing is she's tweeting that out to try to cover up for her deep-seated racism. I mean, deep down, she's like an Alabama sheriff in the year 1962, let's face it. Okay, come on. And then also, right after tweeting that picture, she tweeted a link to an old video that her and Usain Bolt made together. I guess he's been on the show or whatever. Okay, come on, everybody. Come on, guys. Let's get serious here. I think this is actually damaging to actual cases of racism, because this is Boy Who Cried Wolf 101. You're going to call Ellen DeGeneres racist over a joke that was in good fun that Usain Bolt himself liked, when there's actual serious, serious instances of racism going around in the country. And what you do is when you have the same label, the exact same label for Ellen did in the form of a tweet, and I don't know, the fact that black people and white people use drugs at similar rates and black people are arrested four times more often, you're going to have the same label, racist, racist, for both those things. Well, you just cheapened racism. Because now, otherwise normal people will roll their eyes at every fucking claim of racism because you did the Boy Who Cried Wolf. Ellen's racist. Justin Timberlake for fucking saying let's all love each other or whatever is racist from when he said at the BET Awards, when he was watching Jesse Williams' speech at the BET Awards. Justin Timberlake's racist. Ellen DeGeneres is racist. Every racist, 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 racist. And then boom, when there's an actual fucking case of racism where a police officer guns down an unarmed black person with no fucking reason whatsoever, and you say that's racist, a lot of people go, well, I mean, he must have did something, because every time somebody says racism, it's some fake fucking shit. Oh, come on, man. We got to stop with this. We got to stop with this. As somebody who likes to consider myself a part of the movement trying to fight to end systemic racism and trying to create a better society in that way, when I see stuff like this, I think we're in trouble. I do. And I notice it on a lot of my segments too. Like when I talk about legitimate instances of racism, now there's a lot of people, every claim of racism, like it's got to be bullshit by definition because so many claims are false. That's fucking frustrating. Let me just give you one more example of like a real issue that is totally birthed in systemic racism. So the average white family or average white person, they inherit from the previous generation. They have like 120,000 or 140,000 thereabouts in net worth. That's a decent amount, man. That's a lot, right? Black family, it's about between 11,000 and 20,000. If I'm not mistaken, it was, you know, right after the recession, about 11,000. So the inheritance difference. Now, racists would look at that and say, well, that's just because white people work harder. You really believe that? Like, that's convincing to you? You think that's true? If you believe that, you probably actually are a racist. No, the reality is we're talking about inheritance, or we're talking about literally passing down wealth accumulated through generations. How many generations ago was it that we literally had segregation officially in the South, for example? There are people alive today that were in the segregated South. You only have to go fucking one generation to go, oh. So they were handicapped by nature of the system. It was built into the system that they're second-class citizens. And then lo and behold, now they have less money, so they pass down less money to the next generation. And so in the race of life, as a general rule, white people, it's a 100-yard dash. White people go 60 yards in front or more, and then they turn around and go, okay, black people, you can start running now. Well, yes, that would be an issue that's tied to systemic racism. So good people are trying to fight back to fix that. How do we fix that? You need to invest in communities of color and downtrodden communities. That's something you have to do. I would argue a social democratic system would foster uplifting of the races. So, for example, if you do a universal health care system, that would help tremendously. If you do universal education, that would help tremendously. If you make the minimum wage a living wage, that would help tremendously. So there are real ways to fix real problems associated with real racism. And that's what we're fighting for and doing our best to fight for here on Secular Talk. When people take something like Ellen DeGeneres, obviously joking with no malintent whatsoever about Usain Bolt, you're trying too hard. You're looking for instances of things where you can cry racism when deep down, you know it's not racism. You know Ellen fucking DeGeneres isn't racist. You know it. You know it. You know it. You fucking know it. Now, look, you can say, well, she should at least understand the history it's tied to and be cognizant of that. Sure, totally fine. But she is a comedian. And I have there's a Kyle rule on comedy. If it's a comedian and they say something offensive, they almost get, it's almost a 100% pass. Because their whole existence is to push boundaries and try to say shit that evokes a response of laughter. And sometimes they cross that line that we all internally have where we go, that was a little tasteless. But they're allowed to try it and fail. And you don't have to like the joke. You don't have to think it's funny. But if she says it, to ascertain from it that now I think she at heart is a racist and she thinks black people are inferior to white people. Because remember, that's racism is thinking one race is inferior to another race and another race is superior. Well, obviously Ellen doesn't think that. Obviously she doesn't. And Usain Bolt himself was like, that's a funny joke. I'm going to retweet it. So you're trying too hard if you think this is part of the, you know, part of systemic oppression and part of the deep-seated embedded problem in the system. No, there are real deep-seated problems within the system. Yes, this is not one of them. And when you say it is, you damage the actual fight against the real problems.
Okay. All right, let me do one more here. Then we're done for the day. And I could stop my fucking stomach from growling as I'm talking to you guys. The Independent has a story here about a new project in the South in the United States. Activists in Alabama have announced plans to open the nation's first museum dedicated to its dark and often ignored history of the lynching of African Americans. The Montgomery-based Equal Justice Initiative on Tuesday said it intended to open the memorial and museum from enslavement to mass incarceration, which I think is the name of it, on a 6-acre site that would both honor the people who had been murdered and draw attention to those responsible for what it called radical terror lynching. The group has estimated there were at least 4,000 such lynchings between 1877 and 1950. Now they're going to do the museum about 150 yards away from the biggest slave auction site in the South, which is, you know, a way to say, okay, look, see, now we're acknowledging the history and we're doing it in an area which was the heart of the problem, basically. So it's almost like an opportunity to breathe a sigh of relief and say, oh, finally we're at a point now where it's like, well, that the worst atrocities are dead and gone, and we can put the memorial to said atrocities to raise awareness in the spot where we used to have the worst crimes. Now, Brian Stevenson, the founder of EJI, had a really interesting quote about this that I wanted to share with you guys. He said, when you go to South Africa, you are confronted with the legacy of apartheid. If you go to Rwanda, they make sure that you understand what genocide did. If you go to Germany, you can't actually go many places in Berlin without seeing the markers and the stones that have been placed at the homes of Jewish families that were abducted during the Holocaust. The Germans actually want you to go to Auschwitz to confront soberly that legacy. So I think this is really interesting because this story sets up actively a Rorschach test as to, you know, what your political leanings are and how you feel about racial issues. Because I feel like anybody who is liberal, progressive, honestly moderate, and even center-right, like, you know, conservative but not far-right, so like libertarians and people who just are genuinely moderate right-wingers, I think all of them will look at this and go, oh, okay, great, good. Because, again, they described and they explained how this already is the case in so many other countries with so many other atrocities and so many other systems of injustice where they're like, okay, now let's do the right thing, and in an attempt to be past that, in an attempt to acknowledge the sins, you know, it's like building a memorial and saying, here's where you learn about it. The Holocaust Museum, you know, okay, look, now here you learned about the terrible things that happened, so we never get to that place again. So any reasonable person is going to look at this and go, yeah, of course, totally, go for it. It makes perfect sense. And then anybody who is very set in their ways and bordering on bigotry, if not an outright bigot, is going to say, no, why would you do this? Well, I already described why we'd do this. We have the Holocaust Museum. We have things set up in Rwanda for the genocide. You know, we have in apartheid South Africa, there are things where you go to, okay, look, this is what it was. Why wouldn't we do it in our case? Why wouldn't we do it in the case of the United States? Now, that's not to blame all white people today. That's preposterous. You didn't own slaves. You know, you didn't do segregation literally. So if you take it personal, stop. It's not to fucking say, you should fucking feel that. No, it's to say, here's something that happened in history. Let's put this thing up to remind us that it happened, and so that we can avoid stuff like this in the future, and we can raise awareness, and we can understand just how terrible and wrong and evil and bad it was. And also, they do link it to systemic issues today. So again, this isn't to blame any individual people. This is to say, okay, here's what happened, and then by the way, in some ways this was transferred to, like, the new Jim Crow, where it's not nearly as bad as outright slavery, obviously. It's not as bad as outright segregation, obviously. But what it is mass incarceration on the basis of, oh, my God, you put a substance in your body which is so bad and so wrong that we're going to lock you in a fucking cage. It's insanity. It's a way to control segments of the population that the powers that be determine need to be controlled. So that's why black people and white people use drugs at a similar rate. Black people are arrested for it four times more often. And the legacy of this stuff still, to an extent, lives on today. Again, we've gotten much better. There's been a lot of improvement from what happened. But, for example, black families and white families, their average net worth that they inherit, in white families it's over $100,000. Black people it's about $15,000. That hurts you in this world. It's not equal opportunity. You haven't been given equal opportunity. So we need to try to find a way to change the system to make it so you give equal opportunity. Not equality of outcome, where everybody has the same no matter what, no matter how hard they work. Equal opportunity. So a universal healthcare system, universal education system, investment in downtrodden communities. All these things would help. So again, I think all reasonable people will look at this and go, of course. And while we're at it, we should build a fucking, I don't know if this exists or not, but it should if it doesn't, something for the Native American genocide. And that's not to blame fucking white people. I'm a white dude in America. I'm a white American. Do I feel personally, they're blaming me if they put something up for the Native American genocide? No. I feel, oh no, that fucking happened in history. That was a bad thing. We should have a place where you can go to soberly reflect on what happened, learn the facts, and then we avoid shit like this in the future. It's so basic and so important, and for whatever reason, there's still some people who go, no, I don't want to do it. Well, then you got to ask, why are you so defensive, bro? Why the fuck are you so defensive? Why are you so defensive? Yes, the Trail of Tears happened. The Native American genocide happened. Yes, slavery happened. Segregation happened. We've come a long way. But one of the signs that we've come even further and we can go an even longer way is if you do these museums, if you acknowledge it, and if it's something that we show and we broadcast as terrible, let's not let it happen again, and here's where we can soberly reflect. I don't see any downsides to it. Okay. All right, guys. I'm out of time. Love you. We'll see you tomorrow. Mwah. Peace.